For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up in this week's episode, Sophie Haydock introduces us to the four women who dared to model for controversial Austrian artist Egon Schiller. Top actor Adjua Ando looks back on the long and varied list of books that she's narrated for the RNIB. And best-selling author Mark Sullivan retells the story of an extraordinary escape from Ukraine during the Second World War. That's all coming up on today's Read On. The Flames is a fascinating debut from author and journalist Sophie Haydock. The novel was inspired by the real lives of four women who posed for the controversial artist Egon Schiele before his premature death during the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. Here's Sophie to tell us more about the artist and his subjects. Sophie, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here, Red.
For those listeners who might not yet have come across Egon Schiller, please could you tell us a bit about him before we move on to his Flames?
Yes, well, Egon Schiller was an Austrian artist and he was born in 1890. So he's a relic of a bygone era, perhaps, but he had his heyday in Vienna at the turn of the century. And as you can imagine then, Vienna was a hugely atmospheric place full of music and fabulous architecture, discussions about the human soul, Freud, Mozart, all of this beautiful stuff was happening in Vienna at the turn of the 20th century. And Egon Schiele was an artist, he was a young man, and he was heavily influenced by the artist Gustav Klimt, who I'm sure many people have heard of. You know, the beautiful portraits, the Art Nouveau style, lots of gold, really evocative works of art. So Schiele came onto the scene and he was a very charged young man. He'd had a troubled childhood. His father was a station master and he was very strict and he had contracted syphilis, which had a very bad effect on his mental health, on his physical health. He became more and more unpredictable. So Schiele is a product of this very troubled childhood, and he emerges into the Viennese art scene very sexually charged. He made these portraits of women that were controversial. They were very explicit, which, you know, it goes without saying that perhaps the audience of the time, it was all hidden. There was lots of hypocrisy in Vienna at that time. So, of course, the art that sold, you know, that made the most money was the very explicit works of art. And Schiele would paint these very powerful, evocative portraits where women were in states of undress. They might be in their stockings, they might be in their boots or other elements of their underwear, the underwear at the time, so garters and petticoats and all these kind of frilly bits and pieces. And Schiele painted in a very furious way these very compelling portraits, mostly of women but also of himself, and it landed him in a great deal of trouble, and he was imprisoned for the explicitness of his artwork, and he led a tragically short life. But the impact that he's had over the past 100 years has been incredible. I think it's fair to say that he's had an influence on artists today, such as Tracy Emin. He had a big impact on David Bowie, who was heavily influenced by Egon Schiele's use of hands in his artwork. These very stylized hands with elongated fingers presented in these quite, you know, unusual ways with the fingers kind of splayed. So it's interesting to see how far and how deep the reach of Egon Schiele has gone into our modern world.
You've brought out the central part that sex and sexuality plays in Schiele's work, and over the last 100 years his art has been looked at very much through the prism of this is a young man's work
and the women are objects. And yet what you seek to do is to bring to life the four muses, the four women who inspired that artistic outflow. And you mentioned Klimt, and the first woman who really inspired him to paint with this new energy and gusto was actually Klimt's model Vali.
Yes, absolutely. Valburga Nertzl, who in my book is Vali, she met Sheila in the studio of Gustav Klimt. And it's this wonderful idea, whether it's true or not, it was too good to pass up in fiction, because there is this really intense link between Sheila and Gustav Klimt, who was 28 or 30, you know, years older. And I think it's fair to say that Sheila probably saw him as something of a father figure. So his own father had died when he was 14, 15 years old, and he came to Vienna. And as a young man, 17 years old, when he was studying at the Academy of Fine Art, he went very bravely and very boldly to the studio of Gustav Klimt. And he searched out this, you know, renowned artist, and he showed him some of his drawings. And he said to the older man, "Do I have talent?" And it must have been an impossibly difficult question for this precocious young man to ask. But Klimt looked through the drawings and he eventually said, "Yes, you know, you have much too much talent, in fact." Mm-hmm. And it's such a lovely anecdote. And I think that to place Vali, one of Sheila's muses, into Klimt's studio was a really powerful way of, you know, exploring and exposing this link between the two men. Vali was an incredibly influential force on Egon Sheila, and she stood by him through his darkest days when he was imprisoned. And they were together for a few years. You know, it was a very significant relationship for both of them. And yet she gets treated rather badly, and Egon Sheila proposes to another woman while they are still intimate. So instantly I could see all these fantastic kind of overlaps and the potential for heartbreak and betrayal emerging in the stories of the women that were in Egon Sheila's life.
Yes, his appetite to express himself through his art and his sexuality led him to seduce and have a relationship with a neighbour of his, a woman who was better born than Vali, and also her sister.
Yes, this is true. So when Sheila returns to Vienna after this life-changing incident of being in prison and going through a trial, he starts to reassess his life, and he moves to a slightly wealthier area of Vienna. And it's there that he meets the well-to-do sisters who live in the apartment opposite his. And the sisters are called Edith and Adele Harms. And I think at first he's really taken with these two pretty girls. They're his neighbours. They're from a wealthier family than perhaps he's spent time with before. And it's fair to say, I think, that he courted both of them. And Adele, as the older sister, perhaps had an expectation that she would be the first person in the family to marry. And I think it surprised everybody when he proposed to Edith.
And both sisters pose for him. The fact that he married Edith does not stop Adele posing for him. And in many ways, you argue that she is more comfortable with her own body than her younger sister, Sheila's wife.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what I found so fascinating, is I had a postcard of Adele Harms on my wall at university, and it's perhaps one of the most famous pieces of artwork by Egon Sheila. And in it, a woman is sitting down, her legs are spread open, she's got petticoats on, and she's wearing this kind of green chemise. She's got this beautiful auburn hair, and her head is tilted to one side, and she's got a very wistful look in her eyes. And I must have looked at this postcard for, you know, a year during my final year at Leeds University. And it was only after I'd been to an exhibition of Egon Schiele's work at the Courtauld Gallery in 2015 that I put two and two together and realised that this woman, who had all the intensity and vulnerability of a lover, was in fact Egon Schiele's sister-in-law. And this information really stopped me in my tracks, because I thought, wow, would I pose like that for my sister's husband? And what must have been going through her mind at that point to take her clothes off, to expose herself in this way for the man who was married to her sister? So this information really captured my imagination. And also, when I looked at portraits of Edith, the artist's wife, she looks incredibly uncomfortable. There's a beautiful portrait painted by Schiele in 1915, just after he married Edith. And in it, she's wearing this beautiful long dress. It's multicoloured vertical stripes, reds, pinks, greens. It's very vibrant. And Edith just looks so uncomfortable in this portrait. And she's standing with her feet slightly turned inwards, and her index finger and her thumb are touching in the portrait, which makes her look incredibly vulnerable and childlike. And this expression on her face is quite mute, almost like a doll. So it's fair to say that she looked really uncomfortable in the artworks that Schiele made of her. And she'd come from a good family. She wouldn't have been used to taking her clothes off in this way. And then she might be expected to go and deliver these drawings or these paintings to his patrons. And this must have been deeply uncomfortable for her. So this really interesting dynamic cropped up where I thought, obviously, Adele, from the evidence, is more comfortable. Edith is uncomfortable. And this real tension emerged. It's worth saying also that Adele lived to be a much older woman. She died aged 78. And in interviews, Adele did say that she had an affair with Schiele. And this might mean that she had an encounter with him, or that he courted her, or that she had an expectation that she would marry. Or it might mean something more explicit, you know, a sexual relationship. But again, I wanted to use her words and perhaps her delusion. Maybe she'd misinterpreted something. Maybe she'd had expectations that were never realised. And I wanted to draw on all these themes in The Flames and to explore the sisterly relationship and the relationship between artist and muse and how much these women gave of themselves freely.
You mention that you have heard tapes of Adele and also of Schiele's sister Gertrude, who was the fourth of his muses. And I know you've done an enormous amount of research for this book. Tell us a bit about what you found in those recordings and what impression you got of Gertrude, who also, rather surprisingly, took her clothes off for her brother to paint.
Yes, she did. And this, again, was a really pivotal moment for me when I went to the Courtauld Gallery. And again, I saw a portrait of a beautiful woman, this halo of honey, strawberry blonde hair, a beautiful blue ribbon placed in the top, and her arm is raised in it, and she's naked. Her face is slightly turned away, so you can't see her. But you can certainly see her body, and her knees are bent. She's sitting down, but the chair isn't visible. It's a very, very powerful portrait. And it was a moment of surprise when, again, I realised that this wasn't a lover, but this was, in fact, Schiele's sister, his younger sister. And again, I wanted to know, how on earth had she ended up in a position where she was comfortable removing her clothes for her brother? And undoubtedly, they had a very intimate relationship. They shared the same troubled childhood. They had lots of misadventures, you could say. They were both teenagers when they ran away to spend a few days in Trieste, the place where their parents spent their honeymoon. So it was a significant location for them to go to. And apparently they shared a single room in a hotel there. So all this information really sparked lots of questions for me. And Gertrude was a fantastic character because she very much, I believe, knew her own mind, and she seemed, by her own account, to have been very comfortable in this position that she had and this relationship that she had with her brother. And even years later, when she was interviewed at the end of her life, she was very proud of the fact they had a very intimate bond. So it's fascinating, and I think it's very intriguing to think about how these relationships played out between Egon and his sister, and how she might have felt to be so close to her brother in a way that we might not now today understand at all.
Did you get an impression of a kind of magnetism that Sheila had for these four very diverse women? And did you feel it?
That's a great question. I think he must have been a very charismatic young man. He's handsome. I've seen photographs of him, and he had this slick of dark hair, and he dressed very well, tiny kind of polka dot pinpoints on his shirt. I think he would have been considered very handsome by the women of the day. And I'm sure that his rebelliousness and his general attitude to authority and to the world around him would have been quite seductive. Women 100 years ago, just like women today, perhaps, really are drawn to that kind of bad boy, and some things never change. So certainly he would have been a charismatic character. And I definitely felt compelled by his life and his story. And it's hard not to feel great sadness at his untimely death, and to think of what he could have achieved if he'd lived for another 50 years. You know, look at Picasso, at Matisse. These are two men who lived into their 80s, and they had such long artistic careers. And Sheila really only had a decade of great artistic output, and yet he created such a wealth of drawings, watercolours, landscapes, self-portraits. And it's really easy to forget that he was a young man when he was making these portraits, and he was on the brink of becoming a father when he died. Edith was 6 months pregnant with their first child when she succumbed to the Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918. Sheila died 3 days later. So it's a real tragedy that their lives were cut so short. It was very hard not to feel a huge amount of affection and emotion for these, all the characters in the book, definitely.
Now, the book has been brought to life for those of us who can't read print as an audiobook. Did you have much to do with the selection of narrators for that?
Yeah, so it's wonderful because you get sent a list of voices, names, and, you know, a link to their website where you can hear them doing little clips of maybe a commercial or another audiobook. And it's really exciting because you're listening to voices and thinking, could this be Adele? Could this be Gertrude? And very quickly you realize that the voice that you've had in your head all along is captured perfectly by this actor. And it was Hattie Morahan, who is a British actress. She had so much energy to her voice, and I thought she'd be able to navigate very adeptly between four distinct women, one of whom we see as a young woman, and we see her later as a woman aged 78 at the end of her life. So Hattie had a fantastic job on her hands to try and evoke all of that effectively. So I'm really excited. I haven't heard the finished audiobook yet. I heard little snippets as it was being recorded, and they'd send me a word and say, is this the right pronunciation, or should we go for the more German sounding Gertrude, and things like that. So it was really fun for me to get an insight into that. But I'm really excited to hear the finished thing myself, because I think it will be really exceptional and a very different experience for me. You know, I probably won't recognise much of it because it will be transformed in such a special way.
Eva had been distracted as she'd cycled home along this residential backstreet in Vienna's leafy Hitzing district. She'd argued at lunchtime with a man she'd made a tentative life with. They'd met in a coffee shop near where she worked as an assistant at a store selling second-hand books in a tourist-crammed area of the Innerstadt. But what should have been a moment for intimate revelation had become fraught with recrimination. Eva had run from the cafe and her lover had let her go. She'd been rehashing the day's argument, reliving the things she'd said, thinking about the things she should have disclosed. The next thing she remembered was the blurred flash of a figure running into her path. She'd gripped the brakes, tried to swerve, but their momentum was unstoppable.
Hattie Murrahan, narrating The Flames, written by my guest, Sophie Haydock. And for a visually impaired audience, can you describe the cover of the novel, please?
Yes, so it's a navy cover with four frames, gilded frames, which are slightly raised from the surface of the cover. And in them, you get a painting by Sheila of each of these women. So in the top right corner, you have Adele Harms in this very coquettish pose. You have Gertrude on the left with her hands clasped up to her shoulder, looking very innocent and beguiling. In the bottom right, we have Vally Nertzl, who has her head cocked to one side, and she's looking directly at the viewer in what is a very powerful portrait, and one that represented a real shift in Sheila's work. And then in the bottom left, we have Edith Harms in that portrait I spoke about that Sheila made when they were married in 1915, where she's looking quite doll-like and innocent. And I think she said in one of the notes that she wrote that she felt she looked a little dull or dumb. It's really fantastic to know that this book is going to shed a light on these four women. It's very exciting for me.
Do you think if you'd met Sheila, you would have posed for him?
Now that's a great question. I think writers become writers because they like to take a back seat in a way, but I think it would have been very hard to say no to a man like Egon Schiele. I think I might have felt more like Edith and wanted to keep my clothes on rather than do a full Adele or Gertrude and stripped my stockings. In all honesty, it would have been a real privilege to pose for one of the greatest artists of the 20th century.
Well, Sophie Haydock, thank you so much for not only introducing us to Egon Schiele, but more importantly, to the four women who inspired such great artworks.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved every moment of this.
The Flames by Sophie Haydock is available from the RNIB Library. And Sophie will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Mark Sullivan retells an extraordinary true story of resilience and hope in his historical novel, The Last Green Valley. But first, Adjoa Ando is a star of stage, screen, radio and audiobooks. Listeners may know her best as the voice of the number one ladies detective agency. I caught up with Adjoa Ando as she took a break from recording at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'll start off with the number one ladies detective series. Mm-hmm. They sound like great fun to record.
What's interesting about them is they give you a sort of a gentle snapshot into one perspective on Africa. They're gentle books. I think gentle is the word that comes to mind when I think about them. You know, they talk about difficult subjects in a gentle way, and they use Africa as a great backdrop for gentle detective stories with fun characters that you sort of come to know and love as the series develops. And what's great about them is you go from the beginnings of the detective agency, what caused Ma Ramotswe to have the detective agency in the first place, and then the lives of the people who join her. So you know, Ma Makutsi, and then Ma Ramotswe's Mr. Jelbi Matekone, her husband, who has the garage next door, and Futi Radifuti, who marries Ma Makutsi, who owns a furniture shop. So he starts the building blocks of the world, Alexander McCall Smith, and then things come in and out of the world. And the actual detection is only part of the joy of the stories. You just see people develop and grow and have kids and grow up and fall in and out of relationships and friendships and have a sense of the world that they inhabit on a day-to-day basis as well.
Rather like a soap opera.
Yes, yeah, you could say they're sort of a gentle extended soap on the page or, you know, in the audio. Yeah.
I know you've also narrated several more hard-hitting books to do with Africa and the history of slavery. Have any of those really stuck in your mind when you've read them?
Well, I've done a whole heap of, I mean, I must have done over 100, in the hundreds now, of audiobooks. And given that I've got a Ghanaian father and an English mother, a selection of them have been set in Africa, which I love. There's a writer called Aminata Fauna who wrote a book called The Devil Who Danced on the Water, and another book called Ancestor Stones, which are about growing up in Sierra Leone with her father as the finance minister in the first post-independent government. I love her. Her mother was Scottish, her father Sierra Leone. Ancestor Stones is about the lives of four of her aunts. And she does it in a historic way. So she goes back to the founding of the village that her family grew up in. So you get a history of the tribes and the culture of Sierra Leone. But you get these fabulous stories about women who fall in love, women who never marry, women who deal with mental health issues. They are in Sierra Leone. Some of them travel to England. Some of them become businesswomen and travel all over the world. You hear all sorts of things. So you get a history of her family through these four women's stories, and you get a history of the country as well. So it's sort of rather brilliant. And then The Devil Who Danced on Water is about what it was like being a little girl in this country as her father became the finance minister with her Scottish mother, and then the civil war that happens in the country and the fear. And her father is, if it's not a spoiler alert, he's a historical figure. Then her father is hung. So the book is the first 10 years of her life and the last 10 years of his and what happens to them. It's the terrifically moving writing. So those aren't fictional, they're factual books, but really wonderful. So she's a great favourite. Then you get slavery, so you get Africa from another perspective when you look at some of the works that are set in America. Interestingly, I'm here at the moment. We've bumped into each other because I'm recording some science fiction stuff here. There's a fantastic writer called Octavia E. Butler. She was writing science fiction from the 50s onwards. Black woman, extraordinary woman. And I suppose her most popular book is a book called Kindred, which came out in the 70s. Which I haven't actually recorded. Well, I'd love to record it. Maybe I'm putting a little pitch. I'll record Octavia E. Butler's Kindred, anybody. But that tells the story of a woman who, through a sort of time warp in the fabric of, I don't know, whatever it is that we live in, gets flung back into slavery as a black woman. And she doesn't know when it's going to happen. So she can be sitting at her desk writing in America, and suddenly she's sucked back through this time vortex and she's a slave. And when she's a slave, that experience can last for months. And she's experiencing slavery like somebody from our era would experience it, with all the horror and the misunderstanding about what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do and all of that sort of stuff. And then she gets flung back into her contemporary life, and then it goes backwards and forwards. And that book gave me a real chilling sense of what it is like to suddenly have no power or no agency or control over what happens to you. So there's a real range of work out there.
I first came across you when I was reading one of the Anne Leckie books.
Ah, yes.
Another sci-fi writer.
The great Anne Leckie.
And I believe you've read all her books to date.
I think
you?
I have, yes.
The Imperial Raj series.
Yep. What's so great about science fiction work when it's extremely well written and thought through is it becomes a space in which you can talk about our society but not have to be limited by the limits of our society. You can talk about what's possible. You can talk about morality. You can go to extraordinary worlds and have these amazing vistas and senses of what the parameters are that are just free of the limits of our parameters. There's another writer called Alistair Reynolds who is also extraordinary at doing that. And he's a physicist. And I remember reading one of his books where one scene there is a woman whose family heritage is East Africa, who were very close with elephants. And East Africa had become the place where all space study was happening. She is living on a new planet that humans have gone to try to repopulate. And she gets dragged off into intergalactic AI wars. So she's talking to an artificial intelligence, which is manifest as an 8-year-old Chinese girl, but actually is an artificial intelligence that goes right across the universe. And they're talking to another intelligence, a massive female whale. So you've got this East African woman, the small Chinese girl who is really an AI, and a massive talking female whale, all having a conversation about science and what is going to happen to all the different planets. It's just these moments of bliss. And what you also have is you have three female characters not talking about blokes, which is bliss.
I was going to ask you, when you are clearly so busy, you've been a lead actor at the National, the RSC, you've had long-running parts in Casualty, EastEnders, Doctor Who, where you were Martha's mum, MI High, which was my children's favourite programme for a very long time. You are the boss.
I am, yes.
I was going to ask you why you kept coming back to talking books, and I think you've actually answered the question already. You clearly love it.
I do. I love well-written material, and it doesn't really matter what medium. My father, as I say, is from Ghana, and I, you know, he listened to the World Service, and I grew up listening to radio. I love storytelling. I love listening to stories. But also, specifically to the RNIB, I had an uncle who was a great sportsman. He played rugby for England in the 70s and a very physical person who got cancer. And one of the ways it manifested was that he had a tumour that pressed onto his optical nerves and he went blind. So he would listen to a lot of talking books. He would listen to a lot of storytelling. He would make me read things to him. And I really, really began to value the work in that way. Just that opening out of the storytelling, the opening out of the literature. So I like listening to stories and I enjoy sharing that with other people. So I have a particular fondness for the work that RNIB does in that way. Literature should be accessible to everybody. And if I can join in with that, then I'm very happy to. Also, I'm gainfully employed doing something I love. What's not to like about that?
Indeed. And you have a beautiful voice that brings an awful lot of pleasure to those of us who can't actually read the physical copies of books anymore. I'm thoroughly looking forward to a weekend of sitting down and reading the White Giraffe series because I'm interviewing its author, Lauren St. John.
Yes, the White Giraffe series. They were great. Those books were great. They were so great. She has a real skill at, you know, books that are ostensibly aimed at, I don't know, young teen readers, perhaps. But they just work brilliantly for everybody. I found them incredibly moving and engaging, those stories. Great central characters, plucky teenagers having to cope with really difficult and sad and frightening things in their life and finding ways to navigate their way through the world. So, you know, stories that are very exciting but also full of great encouragement.
I do think that the young adult sector of publishing is probably the most exciting at the moment. Gone are the days where we protect children from the fact that people do die and people can be unfair and do get bullied. And yet there's that magical realism that operates in a teenage mind that just flows off the page. It's exciting.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, what's communicating? What's literature? What's storytelling for? I think it's what I call it, it's a heart-to-heart resonance. It's about being able to share experiences. It's about sharing experiences that may not be familiar in the detail of them. But, you know, we all go through the same things in different circumstances and in different ways. And to be able to explore how one copes with different situations and how one triumphs or fails within them and comes to some sort of way of being able to move forward is really important. And that's what's so exciting about stories. You can go anywhere you like with them, really, and that's great. So yes, I think that way of not shielding youngsters from trickiness is just honest, because it's not like they're not experiencing it. Let them read about it, hear about it, share other people's experiences and see and reflect on how they're managing their own.
Yeah, and develop their empathy.
Empathy, coping skills, permission to know it's all right to feel terrible about something and to feel like a failure or a disaster area, and to know that that's not the end of your life.
It's strange. You hear stories about ancillaries, and it seems like the most awful thing, the most viscerally appalling thing the Ratchai have done. To invade and take what? Half the adult population, and turn them into walking corpses slave to your ships, AIs, turned against their own people. If you'd asked me before you annexed us, I'd have said it was a fate worse than death. She turned to me. Is it? None of my bodies is dead, Divine, I said. And your estimate of the typical percentage of annexed populations who were made into ancillaries is excessive. You used to horrify me, said the head priest to me. The very thought of you near was terrifying. Your dead faces, those expressionless voices. But today, I am more horrified at the thought of a unit of living human beings who serve voluntarily, because I don't think I could trust them.
My guest, Adjoa Ando, reading Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. My thanks to Adjoa Ando, and you can find a full list of the books that she has narrated by going to the RNIB Library website at rniblibrary.com. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Sophie Haydock to hear the books of her life, last year, Robert Kirkwood interviewed best-selling author Mark Sullivan about the extraordinary true story behind his new historical novel, The Last Green Valley. With events in Ukraine at the forefront of everybody's minds, it seemed appropriate to rebroadcast this true life story of resilience and hope against the odds.
Mark Sullivan is the acclaimed author of more than 20 novels, including the number one New York Times best-selling Private series, which he writes with James Patterson. His new historical novel, The Last Green Valley, looks at the true story of one family's incredible story of daring, survival and triumph, and the impossible decisions they must make involving the Soviet invasion and the Nazis. It's based on the untold true story of the Martels, a Ukrainian family who fled Europe during Stalin and Hitler's terrorising reigns and began a long, arduous migration west to freedom in Montana. To research the book, Mark Sullivan relived this long trek, trailing the Martels' route through present-day Moldova, Romania, Hungary, the Czech Republic and Poland. And along with surviving children Bill and Walter Martel, who are now both in their 80s, travelled to Ukraine, where they visited for the first time the ruins of their childhood home they fled with their parents. The audio version of the book is narrated by Will Damron.
A cold wind blew in the dawn light. Bombs echoed from the north and east. The rumble of war was getting closer by the minute. 28-year-old Adelina Martel struggled out the back door of her kitchen in heavy winter clothes, carrying a crate full of cooking utensils toward a covered wagon harnessed to two dray horses in front of her modest home in the remote, tiny farming village of Friedenstahl. A damaged German Panzer tank clanked and rattled past her in the early morning light, upsetting the horses. Trucks filled with wounded German soldiers streamed after the tank. Adelina could hear their cries and tortured sufferings long after they'd passed, and she could see more trucks and more horse and mule-drawn wagons like hers coming from the east, silhouetted with the rising sun at their backs.
It's the story of a young family of refugees, mom, dad, two little boys, in a horse-drawn covered wagon, trying to outrun the Soviet Red Army while under the protection of the Nazi SS.
And it's based on a true story.
It is. It's based on the true story of the Martell family. They were ethnic Ukrainians whose ancestors had lived in Ukraine for well over 100 years, and they lived in these agricultural colonies. Life was good until the communist takeover. They were thrown off their lands. Their parents were sent to the gulag. They were treated horribly, starved. The Germans come and invade in 1941, and they give them back their land, and life's pretty good for about 2 years, other than what they see the Germans doing in the early Holocaust. So right at the beginning of the book, as Stalin is counterattacking, they have a decision to make. Are they going to stay and wait for the Soviet bear, or are they going to run with the wolves, the Nazis they've come to despise?
The air stank of horse dung, engine exhaust, spilled petrol, and toiling humans. The din, the cold wind that spoke of a coming storm, the sickening melange of smells, and the nervousness of the horses all conspired to put Adelina further on edge as they loaded the contents of the root cellar into burlap bags while Emil lashed a large rubber bladder of water to the side of the wagon along with the bucket from the well. Overhead and to the south, several kilometers, a German fighter plane roared past them, belching smoke from its engines.
"Mama," Walt said, "I don't like all the loud noises."
"That's why we're leaving," Emil said.
There's no good decision. They go with the Nazis, and what happens on this trek, the actual historical event, the long trek, they're caught in times between the two armies. They're in tank battles, bombardments. They're trying to flee west, and their whole idea is that at some point, they're going to leave the Germans and run for the Western Allied lines and freedom. This is what they dream of. They talk about it as this beautiful green valley where they can live in peace and prosperity. That dream alone and love and family gets them through one of the more incredible ordeals I've ever heard of.
Now, you talk about the long trek. This is a trek that you actually did in research for the book.
Yes, I did. I retraced the entire journey that they went on, starting in going to Ukraine with two of the survivors, the little boys, actually, who are now men in their 80s. And we went to Ukraine and found their ruins of their farmhouse. We went to the site of a prison camp where their father was imprisoned, and he finally escaped from and somehow miraculously found his way back to them and their mother. It was an amazing experience to retrace it and think that they did it all in this wagon or on foot.
Did they have memories of that house?
Oh, very much so. When we confronted that, when we found the ruins, you know, it was just remarkable to watch these two old men seeing the incredible arc of their life going from the ruins that they're looking at all the way to Montana and this incredible life that they built for themselves.
As a former journalist with this book and the previous one, Beneath a Scarlet Sky, is there a temptation just to write a straight non-fiction book, or is the novelist in you always coming out?
There is a temptation to do it, but the thing I'm trying to do is not give you a read about factual events. I want you to go on the trip. I want you to have the experience of sitting on Emil Martell's shoulder or Adeline's shoulder and understand exactly what they went through. This is a book that you'll never forget just because of that approach, the novel approach of bringing it to life.
And the audio version of this book's read by Will Damrod, as is Beneath a Scarlet Sky. Did you have any influence on the narrator?
Yes, I did. Beneath a Scarlet Sky, there were about seven that auditioned, and I thought he was great. He was a fluent Italian speaker as well as English. And he was so good that we decided that he would do an awesome job on Last Green Valley. And he really has. He's remarkable.
Is there not something you're ever tempted to do yourself?
Right now, I'm undergoing a series of mouth operations, so I tend to slur. So no, not this time.
Now, sorry to keep grouping these two books together, but Beneath a Scarlet Sky and The Last Green Valley were quite a departure for you. Was that a deliberate thing to get away from the thriller writing?
No, I found Beneath a Scarlet Sky on the worst day of my life, as is described in that book. And I went to Italy to interview Pino Lella, and the 3-week experience literally changed my life. And I basically had to become a different kind of writer. I had to add all sorts of techniques and tactics to my arsenal of storytelling in order to tell a piece of historical fiction based on a true story. The first one took me 10 years in my spare time. I was writing other books, but Beneath took me a decade. This last Green Valley took me about 2.5 years to write and then a year till publication. So I'm getting quicker at it now that I can focus 100% on it.
Now, you said you went to Italy and you did the long trek. Do you find going to the locations is no excuse for looking them up on Google Maps?
Oh, Google Maps are great. And there are times where I literally go back to the places I've been just to remind myself of what it looked like. But there's no substitute, as far as I'm concerned, for being there, because it makes room for serendipity. You never know who you're going to run into or meet. On this trip, I met this guy who was 98 years old, and he was one of the last survivors of Stalingrad. And he was remarkable. He was hale. He was healthy. He was a beekeeper. He ended up becoming part of the book, and I never expected it.
It doesn't shy away from the very dark side of the journey. Did you find it hard to write that sort of deep despair?
Terrible, because you have to get inside their heads. And I know that they were in deep despair many times. And I had to consistently understand where they were physically, emotionally, spiritually during the entire ordeal. And it was. Some of the stuff was horrible. My wife could describe it to you. I would come in pale from writing it.
And what do you hope readers will take away from the book?
I hope they take away two things. One is that freedom is something that should be cherished. There are people all over the world who would literally die trying to get to it. And the second thing is that there are no limits to the human spirit, that stories like the Martells remind us that remarkable, brutal, almost unfathomable challenges can be endured and overcome and triumphed over. And the Martells are proof.
She watched another tank go by, took a step closer to him, and said quietly, "You're sure, Emil? Running with the Nazis like this?" Emil responded in a whisper, "We can stay and wait for the bear that we know will kill us, or rape you and kill me and the boys, or imprison us all in Siberia. Or we can run with the wolves that will protect us until we can make our escape west. Escape the war. Escape everything."
Mark Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Mark Sullivan. His novel, The Last Green Valley, is available commercially. Now it's back to Sophie Haydock for the books of her life.
Sophie, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, absolutely. I think, like most people, I read from a very young age, and I remember getting obsessed with long series of books. But the book that really captured my imagination when I read it as a teenager was one called I Was Amelia Earhart by Jane Mendelsohn, who is an American author. It was published in 1996, so I would have been around 13 years old when I read it. And it's a fictionalized account of what happened to the aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart after the small plane that she was flying disappeared off the coast of New Guinea one windy day in 1937. And Earhart had become famous as the first woman aviator to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. But there has always been this huge mystery around her disappearance and presumed death. And in the book, Amelia and her navigator, Fred Noonan, they're marooned on this island, and the book imagines how things might have played out for them there. And I think it was this book that made me realise it was possible to write about real historical people and breathe new life into their stories. And I honestly don't think I'd known that it was possible to do that before that moment. And I remember being totally swept up into that world. And of course, nobody knew what had really happened to Earhart. She was this wonderfully compelling figure, a strong woman forging her own path in the world. So it was a complete work of imagination past the point at which she crashed the plane or the plane went missing. It had a really powerful impact on me. And I'd say I definitely, emotionally and mentally, took my first step towards being an author at that point, even if I perhaps didn't know it consciously.
The sky is flesh. I'm flying around the world. A fine perspiration laces my face and neck. It begins to seep down my back. Twisting my left arm around behind me, I locate a can on a shelf. I grab hold of the screwdriver and, steadying the can in my lap, I poke two holes through its metal skin. When I poke the holes, I hear a tiny pop, like the release of a toy gun. Inside the plane, the mindless roar of the engine plays a dull accompaniment to my snack. When I finish the juice, I put the can back on the shelf and lick the last drops of salt from my lips.
Blair Brown, narrating I Was Amelia Earhart, written by Jane Mendelsohn, which is available commercially.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Wow, goodness, there are so many great books to choose from. And it's a rainy day today, so I think it would be perfect to try that out. But it's funny, I don't think I've ever reread a book, which I think is probably quite unusual. I think the one that I'd be in the mood for today is Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi Wood. And I read it back in 2015, just before I went to the exhibition at the Courtauld Gallery that changed my life, the one where I saw the work of Egon Schiele and I had the idea for the book. So Mrs. Hemingway was very much fresh in my mind at that time, and it had a huge influence on me when I realised I had an idea for a book and I was thinking about how to structure it. Mrs. Hemingway, as the title suggests, is about the wives of the American writer Ernest Hemingway. There were four of them, each unique and dazzling in their own right. And the book is divided into four parts with a section dedicated to each of their wives and their experiences with the troubled writer. It begins in the 1920s and we follow Ernest Hemingway via his wives all the way to his death in 1961. And it's such an intimate portrait of an author as seen from the eyes of those who loved him the most. And it had clearly been impeccably researched, but told with a huge amount of affection for the women and insight into their predicaments, as they all get treated rather badly by Hemingway, and there's lots of betrayal and heartbreak. And I'd like to dip back into that world today with the hot summers in the south of France in the 1920s, a place where Hemingway and his first wife, Hadley, are hanging out with Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. And later we see the world through the eyes of Martha Gellhorn, the great war correspondent who was Hemingway's third wife. And she blazed her own path in a man's world. And I think reading that book again would take me back to a time in my life where I was truly on the brink of pursuing my own creative project. And I think it was a time when I was highly attuned to everything around me and I was pulling together lots of influences and inspirations from my life and working out how to channel those into a piece of fiction of my own. And I think the younger me who read Mrs. Hemingway 7 years ago now would be pretty overwhelmed at the way things have played out in the time since then.
I think Ernest and Fife were very fond of each other, Fife's sister had said. That's all she had needed to say. Yes, Hadley would rather be in Paris or even St. Louis right now. These cities which nurse their ashpit skies and clouds of dead sleet. Anywhere but here, in the violet light of glorious Antibes. At night, fruit falls to the grass with a soft thunk, and in the morning she finds the oranges split and stormed by ants. The smell around the villa is ripening, and already, this early, the insects have begun. Hadley gets up and goes over to the window. When she presses her forehead against the glass, she can see his mistress's room. Fife's blinds are closed. Their son, Bumby, sleeps downstairs too, having fended off the whooping cough, the coqueluche, which brought them all to this villa in the first place.
Kate Redding narrating Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi Wood, which is available commercially.
Finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, there certainly is. One of the books that has a very special place on my bookshelf right now is called Moonlight and the Pearler's Daughter, and that's by Lizzie Pook. Lizzie Pook is a fellow debut author, and I was drawn to this book first of all because of its stunning cover. I know they say that you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but this one's really shiny and it's really beautiful, and I just couldn't help but want to get my hands on it and start reading it as quickly as possible. And it's historical fiction, and for once the characters in it aren't based on the lives of real people, but it's set in Western Australia in 1886. And all the action happens in the fictional town of Banning Bay, where 20-year-old Eliza Brightwell awaits the return of her father and brother, who have been at sea for more than 9 weeks, aboard their pearling lugger called the White Starling. And I found it to be a really gripping story about the pearl industry, and it's got this great feminist female character, and it's a real page-turner.
Grasping at her mother's skirts, Eliza steps down to the jetty. As she does, and with the speed of a knife over lard, her feet slide from beneath her and she thuds, backside first, onto the planks. The odour is obscene, but she places a flat palm on the greasy wood. There are fish scales smeared about and stringy meat going crisp in the sun. Come, Eliza. Brush yourself off. Her mother extends a broad, comforting hand. Eliza rubs her elbows, smooths her skirts, and lets her mother tug her to her feet.
Anna Skellen narrating Moonlight and the Pearler's Daughter by Lizzie Pook, which is available commercially.
Sophie Haydock, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me here. I've loved every moment.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at @RedSale and Robert Kirkwood is at @Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.